From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Mention the name George Washington, and what comes to mind? A great man, perhaps, who was tall and stern and, well, let's face it, boring, right? Well, think again.
Under that very restrained facade was a man who was passionate, complex, sensitive, man of strong and fiery opinions, but all of it held in check under this formidable self-control. And the self-control has quite successfully fooled history.
Biographer Ron Chernow reveals the real George Washington. Today, Portraits of Power. Three leading presidential biographers make the case that, to paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, the real test of character is power. We'll hear how John and Abigail Adams shared it. And after 30 years of research and a massive three-volume biography, Edmund Morris is still captivated by Theodore Roosevelt.
He read in three languages, Italian, French, German, and English. He read, on average, a book a day. He read books at the rate of three pages a minute. Flick, 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 flick. You could see the pages just turning under his fingers. And he memorized what he read.
But first, we go back even further in history. Back to one of the ancient world's most fascinating rulers, Cleopatra.
Shall we agree, you and I, upon what Rome really wants? It's always wanted of Egypt. Corn, grain, treasure. It's the old story. Roman greatness built upon Egyptian riches. You shall have them. You shall have them all, and in peace. But there is only one way. My way. Make me queen.
That is Elizabeth Taylor, the sultry star of the 1963 blockbuster Cleopatra. That movie, and much of the legend that surrounded Cleopatra for nearly two millennia, has left a lasting image of the Egyptian queen as a woman who seduced her way to power. But biographer Stacey Schiff says that's what happens to powerful women when men write the history. Schiff's acclaimed new biography portrays the Egyptian queen instead as a shrewd political strategist and a brilliant leader. Schiff talked with Anne Strangchamps about the real and the imaginary Cleopatra.
You have a woman whom we thought was Egyptian, who in fact is Greek. You have a woman who's renowned for her beauty, whom the ancient chroniclers tell us was not particularly beautiful but was eminently charismatic. You have a woman who is immensely wealthy, who was really a lot more than the sum of her seductions, and who in fact was not Elizabeth Taylor either. So there was a lot to sort of move aside. And it's a fascinating moment in history. It's a moment where the whole world will change. With Cleopatra's death goes the Roman Republic, goes Egyptian autonomy. 30 years later, Christ is born, the Roman Empire begins, the Hellenistic Age ends. It's just one of those moments where a woman, which is the other attraction, plays a chief role in the evolution of affairs.
Well, as you write, she's a woman who at one point in her life, for a brief moment, held the fate of the Western world in her hands. How is it that we have arrived at such a misconception of her?
The misconceptions actually begin in her lifetime, which to me is one of the great paradoxes of the story. At the end of her life, Cleopatra is essentially declared an enemy of the Roman Empire by Octavian, who needs to wage war on her and on his former brother-in-law, Mark Antony. Because she is a woman, he has to make her into something much more than just a feckless woman. He has to make her into this eminently powerful, sort of deranged seductress. And that's elaborated on after her death by first the Latin poets who pick up the propagandist baton, and then later by pretty much every manner of chronicler. I mean, Dante has her in the circle of carnal sinners. Shakespeare does quite a good deal with her. The Romantics have a field day with her. And then, of course, by the time film begins, there are all kinds of variations on the theme of the conniving woman.
So who was Cleopatra? Can you put her in her historical context and tell us something about what her early childhood was like?
Well, she's one of five children born to Ptolemy XII. This is a line of sovereigns who descend from one of the generals of Alexander the Great. So they're Greek, they're Macedonians, ruling Egypt after the death of Alexander. And their immediate predicament is how to hold off encroaching Rome, which has pretty much at this point gobbled up the Eastern Mediterranean, with a few exceptions, the wealthiest and most fertile of which is Egypt. She comes to the throne on the death of her father in 51 BC with a younger brother. And it's a somewhat murderous and savage dynasty in which pretty much all the children are raised to rule, and they do their best to sort of shuffle each other off stage so that they might have the chance to do so. So that Cleopatra is within that first year and a half on the throne, embroiled in a civil war against her brother. And in the course of that war, the next youngest sister will also attempt to dethrone her. So there's a real sort of free-for-all here among the siblings, who were clearly, to answer your question, all of them raised to rule. And we know very little about childhood, which was not a big seller in the ancient world, but we do know how Cleopatra was educated, which would have been in precisely the same fashion as Cicero or Caesar or any other well-born Roman, which would have been on a steady diet of Homer with a lot of the Greek playwrights, Aeschylus, Euripides, Sophocles thrown in, with lots of written exercises, enormous amount of training in speaking, but mostly it was a literary culture with Homer as the foundation.
So here she is at 21. She has ascended to the throne of Egypt, an educated woman raised to rule, yet she's fighting for her kingdom's future against Rome. How does she meet Julius Caesar?
Well, Caesar arrives, interestingly, in the midst of his own civil war. He races to Alexandria, trying to himself do in Pompey, whom he has just defeated, only to discover that Pompey has already been done in by the advisors to Cleopatra's brothers. So Caesar washes up in Alexandria with really no immediate mission and without reinforcements to discover that he is a very unwelcome visitor, that the Alexandrians are not happy about having him there. And so he barricades himself into Cleopatra's palace. She is absent because she has been exiled to the desert by her brother. And her immediate problem becomes how to meet Caesar, how, in fact, to argue her case in front of Caesar, which is to get from the eastern Sinai, where she is camped with a bunch of mercenaries, somehow west into the city of Alexandria and into the palace grounds, which are barricaded, all of it undetected. And she does that in a most ingenious way, in a tiny little boat being rowed by a retainer under the palace walls, where she slips into a heavy-duty sack of some kind, and the retainer throws that sack over his shoulder and secrets her into the palace grounds. And that is all we know about her initial meeting with Caesar, but we know it must have gone well because shortly thereafter, she is pregnant with Caesar's child, and the two of them are allies in terms of fighting off the brother, whom they will defeat several months later.
So we don't know what exactly happened between Cleopatra and Caesar, but as you said, several months later, here she is pregnant and they're an item. What do we know about their relationship or about her? You said she wasn't beautiful, but obviously seductive.
You know, what's interesting is what we tend to focus on. I mean, Plutarch very clearly says, here is a woman whose powers of persuasion were extraordinary, whose presence was irresistible, whose charm was irresistible, and her looks were secondary. And of course, we've inverted that equation. He also tells us that Cleopatra, to speak to your question of education, that Cleopatra spoke 9 languages, and she could move easily from one to the next. And as we know from her relationships with Caesar and subsequently with Mark Antony, to move from one kind of man to the next very, very subtly and very easily.
She brought several things to the table. So one was her immense power, charm, her charisma. The other was the wealth of Egypt. You write that the Egyptian palaces made the Romans gasp. What was so luxurious about Egypt at that time?
Well, there are two things. First of all, Alexandria is at the time of is in Cleopatra's lifetime the center of the world. It is the seat of learning. It is the fashion capital. It is the sophisticated city. It has the library and the museum. If you wanted a doctor or a craftsman or a book or an animal trainer, you went to Alexandria. Rome, by comparison, was a muddy provincial backwater where buildings tended to collapse all the time and where you couldn't find a book, actually, if you wanted one. So she reigns, first of all, from the more civilized world, I guess you would say. And secondly, she is the wealthiest person in the Mediterranean world at that time. Egypt is an immensely fertile country. Its wheat is largely what feeds Rome. Everyone in Egypt works for Cleopatra. Everything they make or manufacture contributes in some way to her coffers. And so hers is, by comparison with anyone else's, really an astronomical fortune.
She was also very much a hands-on working ruler. She was a fiscal administrator, controlled her country's currency.
I guess that's one of the pieces where you really do realize how far our misconceptions are from the truth. I mean, here is a woman who runs an enormously bureaucracy-heavy, administration-heavy economy. Everyone reports to her. She has this tremendous number of advisors and of bureaucrats who come to her with reports of the sowing schedule, of the oil proceeds, of everything that ever happens. And she needs to basically spend her day dealing with economic matters, agricultural matters, foreign policy, military policy, and judicial official matters. So she is very much a working dynast, hardly a woman who sat around all day and planned her seductions.
So eventually, things went very badly for Julius Caesar, of course. He wound up assassinated. Cleopatra she'd been in Rome at the time, had to flee, came back to Egypt, and then wound up famously with Mark Antony. How did that come about?
Essentially, after Caesar's death, there is a long and murky period in which it's unclear who will essentially inherit his mantle, who will succeed Caesar. And slowly, two people emerge as the obvious contenders. One is Octavian, who is Caesar's posthumously adopted son. He's the grandson of Caesar's sister. And Mark Antony, who had been one of Caesar's deputies. And essentially the two men who do not like each other will divide the Roman possessions between them, and Mark Antony will take a charge of the East. Cleopatra, therefore, more or less reports to him as a client queen. And she is summoned by Mark Antony, in fact, to what is today southern Turkey for their first meeting so she can explain why over those years when the dust was settling, she did not immediately help Mark Antony in any way and what exactly her allegiance is. And that is when she plans this extraordinary trip up the river, which we know from Shakespeare, who took it from Plutarch, in her golden vessel with her billowing purple sails and her clouds of incense. And she's arrayed herself on deck as Aphrodite with her handmaidens dressed as cupids and nymphs, and lyres are strumming. And she makes her way slowly up the river to Mark Antony, who, the poor dear, has been doing business in the marketplace. But when this apparition appears, realizes he's been deserted by everyone who's gone out to see the arrival of this goddess. And what she seems to be saying there is, I am a queen, you do not summon me. And also, I am in possession of a great fortune, and you are about to head off on a tremendously expensive military expedition. Don't you think I could be useful to you? So, you know, again, it's that wretched excess that so riled the Romans, but it's used to tremendously shrewd political effect. And I should say shortly thereafter, she's pregnant with Mark Antony's twins. So yet again, she has this amazing ability to be pregnant by the right men at the right time. That I can't account for.
It didn't end very well for her. You know, eventually, here comes Octavian from Rome. Mark Antony commits suicide, and so does Cleopatra. What happened?
There is a battle fought at Actium in 31 BC, at which essentially Mark Antony and Cleopatra make a tremendous number of mistakes. And after that, it's just a matter of time before Octavian comes marching into Alexandria. Mark Antony and Cleopatra at this point have begged and pleaded and tried to negotiate with him for some control of the throne. Cleopatra has asked if she can hand her kingdom on to her children. Mark Antony has asked if he kills himself, could Cleopatra be spared? There's all kinds of negotiating. But there are very few answers from Octavian, who is pretty much merciless, and who in the fall of 30 BC will arrive in Alexandria, at which point, yes, Mark Antony commits suicide, thinking that Cleopatra is already dead. And then shortly thereafter, Cleopatra will kill herself as well, knowing that the alternative would have been to have been taken as a prisoner to Rome and paraded down the streets as a piece of war booty.
Stacey, I can't imagine the challenges in writing a biography like this, where the sources are all ancient. There pretty much are no eyewitnesses. How is the actual work of writing this biography different from the other biographies you've written?
I would say that it was a murderous and very trying 4 or 5 years. The hardest part was not having a voice. For years, I had thought this was a great subject, and I just couldn't see a way to do it. And you do have an occasional quote from Plutarch, which indicates that Cleopatra was not only charming and cunning, but actually very funny, or that she had quite a saucy sense of humor. And those, in a way, gave me the courage to start, but it was the lack of that voice that haunted me throughout, as it was the fact that at certain crucial moments, you don't know how she reacts. I mean, she's in Rome when Caesar is murdered. She has essentially banked completely on this man with whom she has a child, and he's gone. The rug has been pulled out from under her completely. How does she react? And of that, we have no record whatsoever. So you're essentially writing around these great unknowns. There was, on the one hand, a great frustration in that. On the other hand, it was a terrific intellectual challenge to see where the material would allow you to go.
Stacey Schiff, talking with Anne Strangechamps. Schiff's book is called Cleopatra, A Life.
The time has come, I think, for us to understand each other. Whatever else I may be, in your opinion, first of all, I am Caesar.
And I am Cleopatra, queen, daughter of Isis.
If I say so, and when I say so, you are what I say you are, nothing more.
Hail Caesar.
You the descendant of generations of inbred, incestuous mental defectives. How dare you call anyone barbarian?
Barbarian?
Daughter of an idiotic flute-playing drunkard who bribed his way to the throne of Egypt.
Your price was too high, remember?
I've had my fill of the smug condescension of you worn-out pretenders, parading on the ruins of your past glories.
The future that concerns me.
If it is, keep out of my affairs and do as I say.
Do as you say? Am I to understand, then, that you feel free to do with me whatever you want, whenever you want?
Elizabeth Taylor and Rex Harrison in the old epic Cleopatra, which may not be historically accurate. It sure is fun to watch. Up next, the real story behind another historical icon, George Washington. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin System eCampus, providing access to online degree programs and certificates offered by the 26 campuses of the UW system. Information is at ecampus.wisconsin.edu.
We're talking this hour about some of the most acclaimed historical biographies of the past year. One of them is Ron Chernow's monumental portrait of George Washington, which logs in at 900-plus pages. Chernow says the Washington who's been handed down to us through the ages is a wooden icon, a man washed clean of his passions and insecurities. He says the real Washington was complicated and flawed, but also an extraordinary political leader. Ron Chernow recently stopped by our studio to talk about our first president.
Thomas Jefferson said that George Washington was naturally high-toned, which was 18th century lingo for high-strung or irritable. Gouverneur Morris, who knew him very well, who wrote the preamble to the Constitution, said George Washington had boiling in his breast passions almost too mighty for man. It was really just this inner circle of the dozen or two dozen people who knew him best, who realized that under that very restrained facade was a man who was passionate, complex, sensitive, man of many moods, of strong and fiery opinions, but all of it held in check under this formidable self-control. And the self-control has quite successfully fooled history.
Well, this is the curious thing to me, because Washington is one of the most written about figures in American history. He's not a new subject, in other words.
Exactly.
And so for a modern biographer to come to George Washington and decide to take on this subject again, not an easy thing, I would think.
No, there have been approximately 900 biographies written about George Washington since he died. So the question naturally arises, how does one have the hubris to perpetrate, you know, number 901? But since 1969, the University of Virginia, they've been publishing a massive new edition of Washington's papers, either letters written by, to, or for George Washington. To give you some sense of how much more we know about Washington, the old edition of his papers, which dated from the 1930s, was based on 17,000 documents. The new edition, started in 1969, that will end in around 2020, is based on 135,000 documents collected from around the world. So we know, actually, it sounds strange, we know more about George Washington than his own contemporaries. I dare say we know more about George Washington than Martha knew about him. You can almost follow him around on an hourly basis.
I don't imagine Martha actually wanted to know many of the things that you've discovered about George.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think Martha, I ended up quite liking her. I think that she was enormously important in his career. She's a very wealthy widow when they meet, so she gives him financial security, projects him into the top ranks of Virginia gentry. And Washington, you know, being a cordial host but of a rather detached sort, has this very skillful woman, and she was a mistress at putting people at their ease. And so, as so often happens with a rootless male in his 20s, Martha creates this kind of very warm and stable environment in which Washington can really create these monumental achievements.
Coming back to the papers, though, yeah. I'm curious, and I think this is something that the casual reader of history or biography doesn't understand, is that if you have 130,000 documents to go through, I assume that a large percentage of those are things that don't matter. And yet you have to read them in order to come to a fuller understanding of the daily life of this man in history.
You know, the truth of the matter is that what may seem completely unimportant to one biographer may seem crucially important to another. Actually, there was a series of letters, to give you one example. One day during Washington's second term as president, he was always very, very frustrated with how operations were going at Mount Vernon, because he was constantly being called away, first 8.5 years for the Revolutionary War, 8 years as president. And so he's constantly writing home. And Mount Vernon was actually 5 farms being supervised by 5 overseers. And finally, late in his second term, he becomes so frustrated by what he sees as the inefficient and rundown state of Mount Vernon that he sits down one Sunday as president and he writes 5 consecutive letters to the 5 overseers. And they're extraordinarily brutal letters. He says to one of the overseers, "There's no more point talking to you than to birds flying overhead. You were lost to all sense of shame," and begins to berate him about his drinking. And then the other 4 letters pretty much follow suit. You know, for me, it underscored something very important about George Washington. This was a very complicated man. In dealing with his military colleagues or his political colleagues, he was someone who was capable of the most exquisite courtesy and sensitivity. But there was this ancient insecurity about money, and any time money was at issue, a different personality emerged, a much more querulous, a testy personality, sometimes, as in this case, you know, a very unattractive personality. But I felt that in order to understand the extraordinary things that this man had accomplished, you had to understand the rough edges, that this was not a soft shoe personality. This was a very fierce, hard-driving, demanding perfectionist. And we've all known bosses like this, and they're not always easy to take.
It strikes me that you may have been uniquely likely to see those letters and understand them because of the background you bring to this business. You wrote about the House of Morgan before you wrote about Washington or Hamilton. You wrote about John D. Rockefeller. You brought a sense of business to history.
Absolutely. And this will sound, you know, very strange, but as I was researching Washington, I kept thinking to myself, he reminds me of someone. He reminds me of someone. And then I realized it was John D. Rockefeller. The same way that people who met John D. Rockefeller outwardly would seem rather bland and even boring, but the people who really got to know him well realized that that furnace of ambition, you know, was boiling inside him all the time. And that was true of George Washington. You know, unlike the other founders, if an Alexander Hamilton or a John Adams or Ben Franklin were sitting at this table, they would want to sparkle. They would impress us within minutes. They were among the most brilliant and witty people we had ever met. George Washington was somebody who was perfectly happy to sit silently through an entire dinner. And so the man's greatness is not in the memorable, you know, witticisms or, you know, the brilliant observations. The man's greatness is in action, an action over prolonged periods, whether it was defeating the British Empire during the war, presiding over the Constitutional Convention, or forging the office of the presidency during his 2 terms in office. It's those great achievements conducted over a long period of time distinguish him rather than the brilliance in the moment.
And yet those great moments in history are the things that do define him for us as we look back at him. But what you've done here is to find other moments that reveal the ambition of the man and the political skill. There was a later instance during the Whiskey Rebellion when mm-hmm. Washington's personality, almost as much as anything, turned it around. And afterward, you would expect more vindictiveness, and there wasn't any.
No, it's amazing because, you know, this is actually the only time in American history that the commander-in-chief, you know, becomes kind of the commander-in-chief in practice. He ends up leading an army out to western Pennsylvania, about 12 or 13,000 men, to put down the whiskey rebels who were rebelling against this excise tax on distilled spirits, the so-called whiskey tax. There had been 6,000 or 7,000 insurgents. The show of force from the federal government causes them to lay down their arms. But about 150 of the ringleaders are arrested, and 2 are tried and convicted of treason, and Washington pardons both of them, so that Washington felt that a show of force was important, but then mercy was. And, you know, he once defined for a British historian his leadership style by saying much is to be gained by prudence, much is to be gained by conciliation, and much by firmness. And it's kind of that's an interesting statement. You see that once Washington made his point, he was not interested in being vindictive.
There are some lessons here that some modern politicians might learn from, aren't there?
I think that there are a lot. Well, I think actually, you know, President Obama came into office hoping to have a very benign and civilized discourse and nonpartisan discourse. He could certainly have avoided that era because Washington became president with exactly the same fantasy and unfortunately exactly the same results. And the two-party system actually sprang up to his dismay within his own cabinet. Yeah, I think that Washington never confused politics with a popularity contest. He felt that leaders should not try to be either liked or loved, but respected. And of course, the irony is, and the lesson here is that, as Washington showed, if you're respected long enough, the public will not only like you, but end up loving you.
You started this biography liking Washington.
Yeah. Yeah.
He became a more fully realized character to you
yeah.
before you could write about him. Did he stay that way? Did you at the end feel that you had brought to life the man you thought you knew?
I hope I did. He starts out as a very unattractive character. He's after money, status, power. He doesn't seem this wise paragon at all. He's someone who tremendously, tremendously transcends his origins, and yet he never completely overcomes, for instance, his early financial insecurities. He's always very testy around the subject of money. So this is a complicated man, but I just had the feeling that someone who oversaw the Continental Army for 8.5 years, defeats the British Empire, it's the greatest military machine of the 18th century. This man had to have been a force of nature. I felt that Americans saw Washington is rather bland and boring, and that there was kind of a feeling, oh, he happened to be the right person at the right time. And if it hadn't been him, it would have been someone else. And I really came to feel that whatever Washington's shortcomings, this was the story not of an ordinary man who did extraordinary things, but really of an extraordinary man who ended up doing extraordinary things. It was not an accidental success.
That's Ron Chernow. His biography is called Washington, A Life. If you'd like to hear more about George Washington, how he navigated the snake pit of revolutionary politics, not to mention the pain of his ivory teeth, you'll find the complete uncut interview on our website at ttbook.org.
You can burn it, you can wave it, you can hang it on the floor. Do whatever you think might score. Really don't amount to very much. Just can't see why there's such a big fuss. Old Teddy Roosevelt, he played a song. Took him all day long, hit me, band.
Coming up, the story of another larger-than-life president, Theodore Roosevelt. And Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Biographer Edmund Morris has been obsessed with Theodore Roosevelt for more than 30 years. His book, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, won both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award in 1980. Its sequel, Theodore Rex, won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize in 2002. Now, Morris has finally finished the last volume of this magisterial biography. It's called Colonel Roosevelt, and picks up the story after T.R. left the White House. Morris told Steve Paulson that Roosevelt was a mass of contradictions.
For example, something that's always perplexed me is that somebody who, like Theodore Roosevelt, loved animals and birds so much with a deep, deep passion, could at the same time get such deep visceral joy out of killing them.
Well, you start your book by talking about his safari in Africa, where the head count must have been huge in terms of the number of animals that he ended up killing in his safari.
Yes, it was large, but it was a scientific safari. He was collecting for the Smithsonian, and he was shooting under a quota. But nevertheless, He shot nearly 300 large specimens in the course of a year, which is carnage enough for most people, although I was interested to find that when he went to Austria and had dinner with the Austrian emperor, Franz Joseph confessed that in his own lifetime he'd shot 50,000 animals.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
So we're talking about a different generation with different values from our own.
Yeah. Well, and that safari in Africa was quite dangerous, wasn't it? I mean, he could have easily gotten killed by some of these animals.
Absolutely. I come from that part of the world. And believe me, when you see a rhinoceros coming, you want to head for the nearest baobab. But within, I think about 10 days after arriving on the Kapiti Plains, he was facing charging lions. And it takes a certain amount of guts to do that.
Yeah. And then not long after that, he then went on a long voyage in Brazil, down uncharted waters there. And that had its own perils, didn't it?
It did. I don't think he was quite aware of how perilous it was going to be. He couldn't resist the opportunity given him by the Brazilian government of exploring an unknown river, the Rio da Dúvida, the River of Doubt, which was thought to be a tributary of the Amazon, but nobody was quite sure. So he accepted the financing of the Brazilian government and started this exploration, and it turned out to be a near catastrophe. He nearly died on its lower reaches from a combination of abscesses and malaria and heart disease, to the point that he was begging his comrades, including his own son, to leave him there to die. They did manage to get him back to Manaus to safety, and he slowly recovered. But the toxins he carried in his system from then on contributed to his death at the age of 60.
So what you're describing is a man who took on extraordinary danger and seemed to court it. And of course, we could go back earlier in his life to the cavalry brigade he led in the war in Cuba. But he was actually quite a sickly and rather timid child, wasn't he?
Oh, he was so sickly that doctors figured that he would probably not last longer than his third year. He had crippling asthma and rheumatic fever and a number of other complaints. So all his childhood and all his teenage years were very frail and very sickly. But he had a gigantic will, and he slowly built up his body, climaxing with a period out west in his mid-20s when he lived and roughed with cowboys, and built up the big, robust physique we're used to seeing in caricatures. But beneath all that muscle and beneath all that brawn was this little timid boy who admitted that his courage had to be self-willed. He taught himself to be brave.
Hmm. It sounds like he consciously set out to remake himself, to become a different kind of person.
He remade himself physically, but I think his spirit was always that of somebody who knew that he was special. It's quite obvious from his teenage diaries and the way he would send posterity letters to his sisters, even as a teenager. Posterity letters being letters that he understood were going to be read in 100 or 200 years' time, which he would sign with his full signature. He was aware even then that he was going to amount to something, and when somebody told him at the age of 26 that he was a likely future president of the United States, he didn't act in the least surprised, and he said, yes, I'll try and be a good one.
But it's also worth pointing out, he was brilliant. Not only did he write something like 40 books, he was steeped in the classics, he was thoroughly cosmopolitan. I mean, we're talking about an extremely intelligent man.
Extremely intelligent and extremely erudite, too. He read, on average, a book a day. He read in three languages, Italian, French, German, and English, and spoke French and German very well. So he understood foreign cultures, and he was also enormously well-traveled long before he became president. In his youth, in his childhood, he spent two grand tours in Europe and the Middle East. Each of them were longer than a year. He was literally a cosmopolitan person, comfortable in many cultures, with an enormous range of friendships around the world.
He also wrote a lot of letters. In fact, didn't I read somewhere that he wrote somewhere between 100 and 150,000 letters?
Quite true. When Harvard inherited his letters in the 1950s, they found indeed there were 150,000 surviving letters.
Well, it raises a question of how he had time to do all of this. I mean, just reading a book a day, that would consume most people.
Well, my wife's explanation is he had servants, which does explain a lot of the productivity of well-born Victorian gentlemen. But he just happened to move mentally and physically that much faster than ordinary human beings. He read books at the rate of 3 pages a minute, flick, 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 flick. You could see the pages just turning under his fingers. And he memorized what he read. He was photographic in his memory. And he also had a compulsion to fill every minute of the day with productive work. For example, if he was waiting for a carriage, which took 3 or 4 minutes to come around the back of the building, he would either read half a chapter of a book or he would scrawl a letter. So he used every minute of the day. And believe it or not, he slept normal hours, 7 to 8 hours every night.
Now, your latest volume picks up the story of Theodore Roosevelt just after he left the presidency in, was it 1910?
And 1909.
1909. He was still a relatively young man, just turned 50. Now, did he still have political ambitions at that time, after he had been president and was off, you know, roaming around the world having these grand adventures?
No, oddly enough. He felt that he'd had 2 terms in the presidency, and that was enough for any man. But the fact that President Taft, who was his hand-picked successor, was making an ineffectual job of it, was compromising his conservationist policies and was being entirely too cozy with big business and Wall Street, these things began to nag at him. So I suppose it was almost inevitable when he got back to America in the summer of 1910 that he would eventually yield to the entreaties of Republican progressives that he should run again for the presidency in 1912.
But ended up starting his own political party. How did that come to happen?
Well, he ran as a Republican for the nomination in the beginning of 1912. And in all the states that voted in primaries, he was the overwhelming favorite of the party. But many states did not have primaries in those days, and they went for Taft because the party machinery controlled them. So in other words, T.R. lost the nomination in a convention which he was quite convinced stole it from him, and he was left with no other alternative but to bolt the party and form the Progressive Party with a capital P, subsequently known as the Bull Moose Party.
Was that a political movement of lasting significance? I mean, the fact that he did start this third party, and I mean, today the word progressive carries certain connotations with that. Do we owe Theodore Roosevelt for some of those ideas that have come down through the progressive movement to this day?
Well, I'm not quite sure what progressive means now. It tends to be a buzzword disguising the dirty word liberal. But in those days, it was something very specific. They had an enormous agenda of social reform, anti-corporate, pro-conservationist, strong defense, with a lot of social legislation protecting women and children, and women's suffrage was a large part of their platform. Such a rich platform, in fact, that even though the party was defeated in 1912, a lot of those reforms filtered down into the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt.
How do you look back on this man you've spent so many years studying? How do you see him in sort of the sweep of American history, and especially presidential history?
I've never fallen in love with him. I think it's extremely dangerous for biographers to be in love. But in toto, in sum, looking back on him as the largest American of his time and one of the largest personalities in our history, I have to admire him profoundly, because as the last line of the book says, in the words of a schoolchild who wrote an epitaph, he was the fulfiller of good intentions. He was a positive force. He represented the best of America, including its dignity and its positivity, and he packed productivity into every moment of his day, every moment of his life. It's been a privilege to be able to write about him now that the trilogy is over. I doubt I'll ever find anybody else quite as large.
Edmund Morris talked with Steve Paulson. His book, Colonel Roosevelt, is the third and final volume of his biography of Theodore Roosevelt.
Hello, folks, heard the jokes that the wise ones crack. They say it is a fact that Teddy can't come back. Just see him fling in the ring his old campaign hat. It's just to show them all you know that he is coming back. So get out and shout and just noise it about.
American presidency has been a man's game, as we all know. But that's not to say, however, that women haven't shaped certain presidents. For instance, it would be hard to imagine John Adams without his wife, Abigail. They were a team. In fact, one of the most successful political partnerships in American history. Abigail was John's confidant and advisor from the beginning of their time together, when he was a lawyer in pre-revolutionary Boston.
You did not like it.
I did not say that.
Oh, you did not have to.
There's not a person in Boston who doubts your education, your command of language.
Oh, dear me, you are charming me, Abigail. You never charm me. Unless what you're about to say is cutting.
John, vanity.
Vain?
You have overburdened your argument with ostentatious erudition. You do not need to quote great men to show you are one.
A scene from the HBO series John Adams, starring Paul Giamatti and Laura Linney. Now, you might figure enough has been written about John Adams to last several lifetimes. But Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Joseph Ellis says one piece of the story has been missing. He tells it in his book, First Family, Abigail and John Adams.
It's a story about love over 59 years and the different colorations of it. They complete each other. And without the other, they are not the same person.
It's fascinating, isn't it, to look at these people and realize how they spring off the page because of all that they wrote to each other?
Yeah, the volume of the letters, about 1,200 between them, is a function of the fact that they were apart so often. Dolly and James Madison don't have nearly as many letters because they were always together. And George Washington told Martha to burn all their letters, which she proceeded to do, all but three. The Adamses then made a point of keeping these letters and in some cases making copies of them. I don't think they knew we would be talking public radio about them 200 years later, but they'd be pleased with that because that was the real reason they're saving these letters for what they call posterity. They understood they were living through a historically significant moment in American history and that they wanted to be able to share that with us and to provide a record for it. John Adams himself was not certain that the Christian notion of the hereafter was true. There really might not be life after death. The only form of immortality that he was certain of is living on in the memory of subsequent generations. That means us. And so the letters were his ticket to that pantheon.
In the very beginning of your book, you talk about how they met. And actually, that's one of the things that you almost have to speculate about, isn't it?
You have a little bit of evidence. Adams met with Abigail in 1759. She was only 15. He was 24. And they met in the parlor of Abigail's father, who's Reverend Smith, the pastor of Weymouth, Massachusetts. It was not love at first sight. And the reason we know that is not from the letters, because they're not going to write at that stage, but from Adams's diary. Adams goes back to his house in Braintree and records in his diary that he had a very uninteresting evening with this unopinionated and very stupid woman. Well, it's obvious that it was not a good occasion, but that over the next few months he has legal work to do in Weymouth and therefore reason to be down there and meets with her and they begin to see each other. And I mean the most sophisticated dating service in America or the world could not have found a couple more compatible.
I'm fascinated by this and I imagine you must have been as well. Frustrated as well, though, because there is the difference between Abigail as described in John's diary then and Abigail as we come to know her. They don't seem to be the same person at all.
Oh, no. I mean, he didn't see the right woman. And of course, she's a bit older. You know, when they marry, she's 20. But her letters from the start are extraordinary. They're more literary than John's. Most scholars think her letters are better than John's. They tend to be longer. She wrote them in the evening after she'd put the kids to bed or after work. He wrote early in the morning, and he was often busy with committees and diplomatic affairs, and so his letters tend not to have the same deliberateness. They're more reports on his thinking, almost impressionistic flows of consciousness. From the start, they recognized that they were a match. They also recognized that they were psychological equals. He liked that. He called her saucy. She had a phrase that her grandmother used, that wild colts make great horses. She was always a very singular personality. Again, not many men would have been able to handle her. John loved it.
It raises a question that I think continues to come up as you read through their lives together, and that is whether the John Adams that we recognize as one of America's great figures, a founding father indeed, could have been that without her, or in fact whether the John Adams that we know is really John and Abigail.
There's a lot to what you just said. Without Abigail, I don't think he could have succeeded at the level that he did. He himself said that. He said that the raging bulls I feel in my soul, she's the only person that can calm me down. I think that he continued to have volcanic moments throughout his public career, but often they happened when she wasn't there. And when he made a big decision in his presidency to send a peace delegation to Paris that was very unpopular, and everybody in Philadelphia said, well, it must be because Abigail wasn't there. She was back up in Quincy, and he would have never done that if she were there. She was recognized by other people in political circles as a formidable stateswoman herself.
It's important to remember, too, that we're not talking about the supportive wife here, although there was some of that supportive spouse in the relationship between the two. We're really talking about an intellectual equal who helped him think through things.
That's right. That's
who may
right.
have, in fact, introduced him to things that he would not have come to on his own.
Well, I think that she introduced him, for example, to the notion that the very arguments he was hurling against George III in Parliament had obvious implications for women's rights. And she pushed him on the slavery issue. She wanted him to take it on. He said, we can't face it directly now. We'll destroy the Union. There is one occasion when she led him astray, and she becomes a sort of ultra-federalist during John's presidency because John's being attacked by the Republican press, the Jeffersonian press, in an unbelievably vicious fashion, suggesting that he intends to crown himself emperor and make John Quincy his heir, that he's got a boatload of prostitutes in London he's bringing over to the presidential mansion, that he's probably crazy. And she supports the passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts and urges him to sign that. I'm not sure he would have signed it without her urging. This is one of the big blunders, the biggest blunder of his presidency, and it effectively gave the government the right to shut down newspapers.
That brings us back to the subject of the letters. One of the reasons that we have so many of them is that they did suffer a lot, suffered not least from separation, especially during, what, the first 10 years of their marriage?
Yeah, he's in Philadelphia at the Continental Congress. She's back up in Braintree. Braintree changes its name to Quincy somewhere in like 1790. But then, see, he's gone to France in 1779. He comes back briefly to write the Massachusetts Constitution single-handedly in 2 weeks. But then he goes over again and is in Paris and in Amsterdam until 1784. And they're apart all that time. And she is truly almost clinically depressed. Letters take 6 months to get from Paris back to the United States at that time. And he wasn't being as good a correspondent as he had promised.
He was concerned, wasn't he, that the letters were going to be intercepted and things he didn't want known might become known?
The war is still going on and British frigates are cruising the sea lanes. And if the British were to capture a ship and he was writing something that could be used as intelligence against the American cause. But I think he was too careful. And she said that to him. She said, my God, who cares whether someone in London knows that we love each other?
Indeed. But there's so many things. You talked about the Massachusetts Constitution, and you say he wrote it single-handedly in the course of 2 weeks. Probably true, but I also have the impression that it would not have been the same document if he hadn't given it to her first.
You're right. Every night when he wrote, after he wrote, he read it out loud to her. There was the distinctive feature of the Massachusetts Constitution, which becomes the basis for the federal Constitution, is separation of powers. But he gives the executive branch a total veto over all legislation. And she tries to change his mind on that, saying that it's going to be accused of being monarchy. which is exactly what happens. And they overrule him on that particular provision, and they allow the governor in this case to have a veto, but he can be overturned with a two-thirds majority. So you can tell from the conversation and the letters between them that he and she have been arguing about political philosophy, basically. There are scenes that are just like she's shelling peas and he's reading to her from Locke's Second Treatise on Government, or Descartes. They shared that interest in books and reading. And she was actually, in terms of poetry and literature, better read than he was.
We've talked a little bit about Adams as president and the decisions that he made, most of which are remembered fondly. There was the Alien and Sedition Act. You as a historian can't be unaware of presidential politics in our own time. Mm-hmm. How do you see Adams and the difficulties he faced both as president and in running for president in light of what's going on now?
Well, I guess this is a personal opinion of mine, and so it's not a scholarly judgment as much as a reflection of my political convictions. I see Adams as the anti-Bush. I think that George Bush took us into an unnecessary war in part to assure his reelection as a second term. Adams chose not to go to war and therefore didn't win a second term, knowing that that would be the consequence. And he later said that that's what he wanted on his tombstone. He kept us out of a war that we were going to get into. He's the one who stopped it. I think that he is also a person who would find the kind of blog partisanship difficult. He found it difficult back then. He would find it even more difficult now because he didn't believe that a president should be the head of a political party. He thought a president should stand above party. He also was not a Democrat in the full sense of the D Democrat, meaning he didn't think the people were always right. In fact, they were often wrong. And that when he did things that were unpopular, like, say, defend the British troops in the Boston Massacre, and he suffered criticism, he knew he must be right. Even when he lost the election in 1800, he said, see, I must have done the right thing because they voted against me. It's a contrary and almost perverse position, but it means that the goal of a president is to serve the public, res publica, the public. The public is the long-term interest of the people, which at any given moment the people don't know. And what a leader is supposed to do is do the right thing. So the last thing you do is check polls. And if it turns out that toss you out of office, that's the price you pay for doing the right thing. And that's what he said was going to happen to John Quincy, too. And it did.
Joseph Ellis is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. His latest book is First Family, Abigail and John Adams. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Three Presidents and a Queen, number 19A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.